Tu e te rangi e tū nei, tu e te papa e takoto kei wahora, tu e rātou ko wehi atu ki te pō uriuri, te pō tangotango, tu e te hongaora ki te hongaora, o tira tu e ngā tangata whenua o tēnei ao ki te papa whenua, tu e hoki ngā tangata whenua o te ao whānui tui e. Chancellor, the verse I've just recited reminds us of the close and enduring bonds between people, the land, and the sky. It also remembers those whose journeys preceded our own and recognises the spirit of unity present among us here tonight. And it pays tribute to the traditional owners of this land and their long-standing attachment to the earth, while acknowledging the sense of connectedness between Indigenous peoples all over the world. Chancellor, ladies and gentlemen, it is indeed an honour to be asked to deliver the 2009 Ngāra Oration, especially as it coincides with the launch of Murup Barak, the Melbourne Institute for Indigenous Development. My wife and I, as well as the other Māori academics who are here tonight, are deeply appreciative of the welcome. Thank you, Auntie Joy. And we appreciate the chance to participate in this landmark ceremony, accompanied as it is by the prospect of strengthened partnerships in the years ahead. The Ngāra Oration presents an opportunity to consider the more recent journeys of Indigenous peoples and the mutual benefits that might arise from teaching and research within universities. Although much can be said about Indigenous development, the good news is that there's actually only one single conclusion underlying this oration. Simply, by bringing together two bodies of knowledge, there will be better prospects than either one could offer alone. The concurrence of the two, Indigenous knowledge on the one hand, and the knowledge contained in the universal academic disciplines, will afford greater opportunities for Indigenous peoples to participate in global economies while retaining those elements of custom and culture that will be important to future generations. In parallel, there will be greater incentives for the academy, the university, to create a type of scholarship that will be distinctive, grounded in the Australian landscape, germane to all learners, and relevant to national and global goals. In a world where technological innovation and scientific discovery are proceeding at unprecedented rates, the appreciation of different systems of knowledge will be increasingly important, so that approaches to human advancement might be both relevant and balanced. Bringing together different bodies of knowledge does not infer an amalgamation or a fusion of traditions, but it recognises that together, the elaboration of old knowledge and the creation of new knowledge have the potential to offer fresh insights. In that respect, the deliberate inclusion of Indigenous peoples and Indigenous knowledge in the academy will bring with it the chance of creating a model of engagement where the politics of difference can be transformed into the spirit of partnership, and the old and the new can be seen as allies rather than adversaries. It could be argued that in a new world, there is no place for old knowledge, or that because Indigenous knowledge often defies scientific measurement, it amounts to little. But the perception of Indigenous knowledge and culture as applicable only to distant times ignores the thrust for development that is actually part of the Indigenous journey, and it fails to capture Indigenous vitality and the meaning of resilience. At the same time, the suggestion that universities, academic institutions, the suggestion that they have a perfect model for future development falls well short of the ideal. Too often, for example, economic growth and environmental sustainability have travelled in opposite directions. Social equity and individual freedoms have not always reached the same endpoint. Enhanced educational achievement has often been the preserve of the few, and the humanities have been studied as if they bore no relationship to the sciences or to technological innovation. As institutions that shape attitudes and mould societies, universities are well placed to lead an integrated approach to development and the promotion of social cohesion. The inclusion of Indigenous peoples and Indigenous knowledge within a university framework of connected development will represent a major step towards achieving those goals of social cohesion. For some Indigenous communities, I expect there will be a degree of scepticism about the capacity of a university to contribute to Indigenous development. But it is well to remember that the resilience of Indigenous populations owes much to an ability to adjust to changing circumstances and to engage with new institutions and new opportunities. The possibility of extinction of a whole population, which was widely predicted for Māori in New Zealand towards the close of the 19th century, for example, was met by a major rejuvenation of tribal initiative, better access to education, and Māori leadership in national politics and in public health. Similar demographic trends have also been seen in Australia. A rapid decline of pre-contact population, which was thought to be more than a million, followed by a dramatic increase during the 20th century. And as in New Zealand, education has played a major role in the demographic reversal. In more recent times, the vulnerability and the rights of Indigenous peoples have assumed a global theme and have become part of a worldwide agenda. In 1949, the United Nations General Assembly identified a number of characteristics shared by Indigenous populations and emphasised the importance of reclaiming native languages and cultures. It was an important milestone in modern Indigenous development. But for Indigenous people themselves, the retention of Indigenous values and customs, important as they were not necessarily the only or the most significant goals. Progressively, there has been a shift in aspirations from the 1949 focus on language and culture to a broader platform where the relevance of indigeneity to modern times has been articulated and the rights of Indigenous peoples to participate fully in society, in the economy, and in education have been championed. The modern agenda for Indigenous development across the globe is probably best reflected in the Declaration of Indigenous Rights. After 22 years in the making, the United Nations General Assembly finally approved the Declaration in 2007. The Declaration addresses both individual and collective rights, cultural rights and identity, rights to education, health, and among other things, rights to employment. It explicitly encourages harmonious and cooperative relations between states and Indigenous peoples. It prohibits discrimination against Indigenous peoples and promotes their full and effective participation in all matters that concern them. It has been described as a fundamentally remedial instrument that aims to overcome the marginalisation and discrimination endured by Indigenous peoples across the world following colonisation, conquest, and dispossession. Although the Declaration does not override domestic law, it is nonetheless an important aspirational statement against which all states, including those that did not sign the declaration, and they were Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States, and some more, including those countries, the declaration is a yardstick against which progress can be measured with an international framework. Meanwhile, since 2007, both Australia and Samoa have endorsed the declaration. Indeed, Australia has gone further. On the 13th of September 2008, Prime Minister Kevin Rudd offered an apology to Australia's Indigenous peoples that recognised the legacy of trauma and grief they had suffered. That apology was to mark a beginning in which new hope was possible. Well, building on the foundations laid over the past quarter century, a new age is indeed approaching. In the new era, Indigenous participation in modern societies will not only reflect Indigenous values, Indigenous cultures and styles of leadership, but it will also be measured by high levels of inclusion in the professions, in a wide range of industries, in science, provider organisations, and in the arts. At a time when the globe is threatened by climate change, environmental instability, and food shortages, Indigenous worldviews have the strong potential to add insights into environmental management and eco-conservation, and to refocus the balance between economic and social agendas. Although the circumstances of Indigenous people vary greatly, there are a number of themes that are common to Indigenous populations living in developed countries. Māori development in New Zealand over the past 25 years, for example, has highlighted four key themes. The first theme is about time, and it acknowledges that development needs to be measured over a period of decades rather than a period of years. Transformations do not occur overnight, and they're linked less to the resolution of immediate crises than to setting longer-term goals built around the needs of future generations. Too often, an exclusive focus on current problems obscures the vision of what could be and frames the Indigenous challenge as a series of calamities built around deficits and disparities. A second theme, at least in New Zealand, is linked to integrated development. Policies and programs based around the various sectors of health, economics, education, social welfare, the environment and justice often lead to disjointed efforts that fly in the face of Indigenous worldviews where holistic understandings make much more sense than piecemeal approaches. Families do not live their lives in sectors, but are often subjected to sectoral interventions that have a fragmenting rather than a consolidating influence. Similarly, Indigenous engagement with academic institutions has often been complicated by a wide array of subject areas, each of which addresses part of the whole, but without conveying a real sense of consistency or holism. A third development theme revolves around Indigenous leadership. New patterns of Māori leadership have emerged over the past 25 years. Leaders are now more inclined to be strategic, forward-thinking, comfortable working at the interface between wider society and Indigenous worlds, and increasingly adept at leading tribal gatherings as well as chairing boardroom meetings. Moreover, the days of charismatic leadership constructed around one or two high-profile leaders have been increasingly supplemented by leadership networks that cut across sectors, tribes, industries, levels of education, political persuasions, and academic disciplines. The fourth theme is about relationships. Quite apart from alliances between the tribes, there has been an increasing trend towards future-focused relationships with the Crown, with the private sector, with industry, Indigenous peoples in other jurisdictions, and with the knowledge sector. Competitive and antagonistic interactions are giving way to relationships based around shared agendas for the future and a greater sense of joint ownership. Moreover, relationships are now frequently formalised as partnerships and carry expectations of equality and enduring associations. In that respect, Murup Barak, the Melbourne Institute for Indigenous Development, is founded on the concept of partnership rather than on one-sided authority or narrowly defined expertise. A partnership is different from a merger, insofar as it does not demand any loss of independence or loss of identity. And a partnership is the antithesis of a takeover, where equality is sacrificed for dominance and difference is transformed into sameness. In contrast, partnerships carry the promise of mutual benefits based on mutual contributions. There is a commitment to respect the integrity of the other and to avoid compromising the core values and the ideals that are dear to the traditions of each partner. Equality of voice, mutual trust, frequent opportunities for dialogue, and the identification of common goals will strengthen partnerships. But partnerships will be weakened by the onset of adversarial bargaining or unattainable expectations that must inevitably fail. In any event, engagement with the knowledge sector can be expected to deliver substantial benefits to Indigenous populations in the 21st century. The application of old understandings on the one hand and the creation of new pathways on the other have the potential to heighten appreciation of the nature of the world and to offer greater insights into human potential in the decades ahead. There is no single body of knowledge that can provide the total insights necessary for human advancement. Moreover, there are few opportunities to study at the interface between bodies of knowledge. Even when interface learning does occur, it is all too often accompanied by vigorous efforts to apply the criteria of one system to rationalise the basis for the other. In the process, validity and integrity are distorted, if not lost. That point was well made by Professor Ian Anderson in his 1993 Boyer lecture. He said, "Koori life experience and medical practice are not diametrically opposed. However, the skills required in getting consensus are not intuitive, nor are they necessarily facilitated by traditional modes of clinical interaction." The establishment of the Melbourne Institute for Indigenous Development signals a shift away from a parallel approach where different bodies of knowledge are locked into trajectories that never meet, and it signals a move towards a set of interacting pathways where a mix of ideas, values, and methodologies become available to accelerate inventiveness and add perspective to the human condition. An institute built on the several strands of Indigenous knowledge, together with the many disciplines of science, economics, jurisprudence, medicine, and the humanities, will have the potential to shape knowledge and inspire discovery in ways that have hitherto been unrealised. A number of beliefs underlie this notion of learning and research at the interface. But four principles have particular implication for both policy and practice, and they are mutual respect, shared benefits, human dignity, and discovery. The first of those principles, mutual respect, endorses the worldview of each party. Essentially, mutual respect recognises the validity of both knowledge systems, Indigenous knowledge and science, and accepts that each needs to be given its own space. Mutual respect extends to recognising different levels of expertise and alternate credentialing processes, as well as different appreciations of evidence and information transfer. A second principle, shared benefits, reverses outmoded assumptions about learning and research that often left Indigenous people as passive respondents who derived little or no benefit from the research. A major loss of confidence in universities occurred when the benefits were not apparent, except to academics, and Indigenous communities often felt both exploited and devalued in a process that disregarded their own views and their own autonomy. A share in the benefits of new knowledge also has particular implications for the assignment of intellectual property and the commercialisation of research findings. Human dignity is also an important principle for both teaching and research. It can be applied to relationships between teachers and learners, to research teams and communities, and between the university and the many populations it serves. The principle of human dignity implies that although worldviews may not be shared, personal integrity and cultural identity should not be devalued or lightly dismissed because they do not accord with the belief systems of others. Human dignity takes into account the worldviews of individuals and groups. It has ethical connotations and particular implications for the way teaching and research programs are designed, implemented, and applied without compromising spiritual beliefs. And the fourth principle, discovery, emphasizes both exploration and invention. Discovery of new knowledge is at the heart of all research endeavors. In research at the interface, discovery owes its innovation to insights drawn from two knowledge systems that have fostered explorations in directions not possible by recourse to one system only. As well, in addition to the notion of breakthrough, discovery also carries hope for the future. In that respect, no culture is static. Indigenous knowledge systems carry a formula for exploring the future, for understanding the nature and origin of phenomena, and the connections and relationships between phenomena. The application of the development themes and partnership principles has huge potential to generate new levels of Indigenous capability. University graduates who will take their place in the several professions of teaching, medicine, business, law, environmental management, while at the same time remaining close to their own people and contributing to their advancement. To a large extent, the realisation of that potential will depend on wise leadership and trusting relationships between leaders. In turn, effective leadership requires courage to move beyond institutional conventions, whether those conventions be exercised within Indigenous zones of comfort or inside the hallowed halls of learning, and to embrace difference as a source of inventiveness rather than a cause for suspicion. Leaders must be wise on two fronts. They must be able to establish relationships with each other, and they must be able to persuade their own people that a partnership with another group will bring beneficial results not otherwise attainable. As leaders in the academy, the university, Indigenous teachers and researchers play crucial roles in straddling the divide between Western academic teaching and research and Indigenous knowledge. They have access to Indigenous populations and also to two systems of knowledge. They are equally aware of the rules for engagement with Indigenous communities and the demands of robust methodologies. At the same time, they may well face criticism from two fronts. Indigenous communities may feel that Indigenous academics are tainted by Western academic conventions and have become somewhat detached from actual Indigenous experiences. Academics, on the other hand, may complain that Indigenous approaches introduce unnecessary variables such as ethical requirements, which limit the integrity of their studies and confuse scientific principles with political imperatives. Both criticisms imply that pluralism at the interface will weaken integrity and undermine identity. But provided there is sound grounding in the two methodological streams and clarity about the contribution that each can make, those risks can be overcome. In addition, of course, to academic staff who can relate to the Indigenous situation and to Indigenous students, success will also be determined by the overall campus experience. Unless the wider culture of the learning environment can impart a sense of belonging, it will fail to capture sustained Indigenous attention. Strengthening identity and developing mastery can be facilitated through designated physical spaces, through cultural events, and counselling programs that aid the transition from native communities to university and later to professional life. Chancellor, it has been an honour to deliver the Ngarim Oration for 2009 and to witness the launch of Murrup Barak, the Melbourne Institute for Indigenous Development. We bring with us the good wishes of fellow Māori academics in New Zealand, from the Vice-Chancellor and academic staff at Massey University, and from the fellows of Te Mata o Te Tau, the Massey University Academy for Māori Research and Scholarship. Congratulations on establishing an institute that is destined to provide a model for development, not only in this country, but in all countries where Indigenous knowledge and academic disciplines have the opportunity to come together. And we applaud the efforts of Professor Ian Anderson for his leadership and vision over the years. Chancellor, ladies and gentlemen, this oration has touched on some of the considerations that will be important to Indigenous development in the future. Over the past 25 years, adaptive Indigenous transitions have laid strong foundations for major transformations of communities, capabilities, and economies. States have progressively recognised the special significance of Indigenous populations, not only as bridges to past traditions and ancient wisdoms, but also as contributors to future development. There has also been an increasing realisation of the benefits that can accrue from Indigenous relationships with other entities, whether within the state or beyond the state. Especially important has been the development of relationships with the knowledge sector. Education in all its forms and with all the accompanying technology has been identified as a major highway for the next phase of Indigenous development. And in that respect, Indigenous partnerships with universities are about unleashing potential and promoting sustainable social, cultural, economic, and environmental transformations. The Melbourne Institute for Indigenous Development is well placed to play a leadership role by providing a forum where the knowledge resources of the university can be brought alongside the knowledge resources of Indigenous communities. The interface between the two knowledge systems can be a rich source of discovery and innovation with mutual gains and shared rewards. It also offers benefits to the nation, and in that respect, it will contribute to the Australian Prime Minister's aspiration for a new era of relations between states and Indigenous peoples. A key to success will be the way in which leaders in the Institute can gain the support of their followers and build enduring relationships with leaders in other parts of the university, with other Indigenous community leaders, and with Indigenous leaders in other countries. Possibly, however, the most important conclusion is that although Indigenous development is largely focused on today's urgent problems, those problems should not obscure the vision for the future. While the past 25 years or more have been about securing a place in modern societies, the next 25 years will build on those foundations so that Indigenous peoples, as members of increasingly global societies, can retain the customs and resources which are at the heart of their culture, while at the same time participating fully in education, in the economy, and in the development of an agenda for the future. And finally, kia tau hoki te marino, kia tipu ake te mātauranga, kia puawai ngā moimoia a rātou mā I roto I te kotahitanga me te whakapono. May peace and calm always be with us. May knowledge and learning forever grow. And may the dreams of those who have since departed be realised in a spirit of unity and trust. Tēnā koutou katoa. Thank you, Chancellor.
Auntie Joy, Chancellor, Vice-Chancellor, Professor Adamson, Professors Jury. Professor Jury, you have given us a remarkable blueprint for the development of this important institute. You've talked about the coming together of knowledges and at the interface and at the partnerships that need to occur in the setting of mutual respect, of shared benefit, and of human dignity. Your words, I think, have moved us all and have taken us, I think, that journey from our talk of Auntie Joy's elders and ancestors and to the time of 25 years ago when it was the difference between Indigenous and non-Indigenous that led perhaps to the leadership we've seen in your own case and also Professor Anderson. It is not a coincidence, I believe, that they are both physicians, one a psychiatrist and one also medically qualified. Professor Jury's work has been described as the most quoted part of his work related to Maori health and the concept of Wari Tapu Wā, and apologies for any mispronunciation, where he brought together a model of an understanding, a Maori understanding of health. And in that model, there are four dimensions to health. There's the physical well-being, the mental and emotional well-being, the social well-being, and the spiritual well-being. Each of those four dimensions influences and supports the others in what we now identify as a classic model of public health. Both Professor Jury and Professor Anderson have come from their areas of clinical expertise to recognise the great deficits there has been in Aboriginal and Indigenous health. But the talk tonight shows us how far we have moved beyond that. We have talked of closing the gap, we've talked about apologies, but now what we are recognising in the leaders from the Indigenous communities is not just the culture, but the knowledge that they bring. And it is a mutual respect of that shared knowledge that I think we will see so importantly played out in the Institute. So I thank you. You've laid down some firm challenges and some good guidelines for the development